Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better. On this episode, in the red corner, the groundhog is a rodent belonging to the group of large ground squirrels known as marmots. They live in lowland areas and are mostly herbivorous, eating primarily wild grasses and other vegetation, including berries and agricultural crops. They also control time, as Bill Murray finds out when one such magical rat traps him in the same day over and over again. From 1993, it's Groundhog Day.
Bill's about to find out he's not just stuck in Punxsutawney.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
Chance of departure today, 100%.
He's stuck.
It's Groundhog Day!
In Groundhog Day.
I'm reliving the same day over and over.
While in the blue corner, to quote Charles Dickens, in a word, I was too cowardly to know what I knew to be right, as I had been too cowardly to avoid doing what I knew to be wrong. Not to badmouth Dickens, but that is more than a word, idiot. But forgive and forget, as Tom Cruise learns how to stop being a coward and smash up some alien scum again and again in 2014's Edge of Tomorrow / Live, Die, Repeat.
You see, this isn't the first time. Now, we've had this conversation. I'm not a soldier.
Of course you're not. You're a weapon.
So what connects these two movies and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crumpton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
And as you just heard, this week we are doing Edge of Tomorrow / Live, Die, Repeat versus Groundhog Day. Who picked these movies?
I picked these movies. Would you like to come up with a funny link between the pair of them?
Yeah, I've got to.
Great.
Well, after that invitation, yeah. How can I say no?
Let's call it what it is.
Also, I just wanted to apologise because I used to hate this bit and now I really like it. Yeah. So,
trust me.
Yeah, just shows you can change your mind. Okay, here we go. Ready?
You got your hand up. I haven't done funny ones this week. I've done serious ones.
Well, okay. We'll go funny first and
right,
then...
Wait, here's my first one. Ready? But, like, think about it.
Okay.
Are they memorable time travel movies? Do you get it?
Yeah.
Okay, next
one. Are you going to do a funny one, though?
Yeah. Time travel movies that don't star Rachel McAdams. She's in all the other ones.
Oh. Is she?
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, the astronaut's wife.
Yeah,
Time Traveler's Wife.
Wife.
Wait, well, she went into that's space
a,
one.
Is that a Johnny Depp one? That's a Johnny Depp one where he comes back an alien.
Yeah. I thought it was the book, but it's just two things, isn't it?
What?
There's a book, a really famous book, but is that the time? Boring. See, this bit is boring. That was right.
Wait, I got some. Okay. Is it that both of our protagonists wake up at exactly 6 a.m. when the day restarts?
Good spot.
Okay, is it... Got another one. Is it that both films were made by people with, let's call it, a maverick approach to filmmaking in Doug Liman and Bill Murray?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a final one. Is it this...
Rita, Rita, Rita. Rita, 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 Rita.
Nope.
Oh. Did you? Is that you singing?
No.
Bless you.
Please
for thinking,
say yes. Please say yes.
Thinking I had a voice like silk. No, that's a guy who I should, probably should credit. It's called The Guy Who Sings Your Name Over and Over on YouTube.
Wow. Oh,
you tell
nice.
Him your name and he makes a song out of it. And he did Rita and I found it and that's that.
Oh, so you didn't pay him for that?
No.
Oh,
no. God. No, but don't say that because probably should have done it.
Well, because it is Groundhog Day this week, I picked two films where history repeats itself, essentially. So we've got, quite obviously, Groundhog Day and Edge of Tomorrow. So who did I give Groundhog Day to?
Me.
Go for it,
if it counts as a comedy, which I think it does.
Just to clarify that, in case you understood the Rita thing.
I did, but I'd totally forgotten.
Yeah. Andy McDowell's called Rita and Emily Blunt's called Rita.
It's weird, isn't it?
Okay, I just didn't want anyone to go, the fuck was that?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I should. Yeah.
Pull your weight, Chris.
Okay, are you ready? Now, I want you to think about this because it's actually pretty clever.
That's the second time you said this already, this podcast. Do we not normally think?
I just feel like I'm going to have a good week.
Also, I really think it should be left to other people to judge how clever it is. I don't think you should prefix everything with, by the way, this is fucking clever.
Well, let's see, shall we? See if you get it or not. Ready? Okay. Yesterday, I watched Groundhog Day and I hated it, so I went to bed. Then yesterday, I watched Groundhog Day and I actually quite liked it and I went to bed. Then yesterday, I watched Groundhog Day again and I loved it and I went to bed and I woke up today and now I'm here. That's right.
We should have done The Astronaut's Wife.
Excellent.
You like it?
Mm. I did. That was, okay. It was special.
Thank you.
Weatherman Phil Connors. He's stuck. Groundhog Day.
Well, it's Groundhog Day. Again?
To get what his heart wants most.
What are you looking for, Phil? A date for the weekend?
Means living this day over again till he gets it right.
Believe it or not, I studied 19th century French poetry.
What a waste of time.
I studied 19th century French poetry.
La fille qui j'aimera.
You speak French?
Oui.
So I'm going to assume that a lot of people have seen this film because it's part of my childhood nostalgia.
Did you guys see it when it came out? I'm taking it for granted this was a cinema trip for you.
It was actually. It's one of the few group cinema trips me and my friends took when we weren't tabletop wargaming. We actually went to see this. Shut up.
Sorry, nothing. So it was written by Danny Rubin and Harold Ramis, who also worked on the script. He directed it. Danny Rubin wanted to write about someone immortal and what that would be like for that person. And I believe he was writing it in January. And so he wanted to claim a holiday to sort of give it a bit more memorability. Is that a right word?
No.
No? Fine. And the next public holiday, which we don't have, is Groundhog Day. So there you go.
But I don't think it was a big thing at the time in the US. I think it became something after this movie. He literally just found it in a calendar and it was like, right,
that'll do.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I know way too much about the writing of this film because I've written a book called How to Write Groundhog Day.
Really?
By Danny Rubin. I've now read it twice because I reread it for this podcast where
is that a joke?
No, that one's not a joke.
Right. He's very clever.
He sort of tops and tails it with talking about the behind the scenes stuff, but also in the middle of it, he's got his original script, the spec script that he wrote with all the differences I'm sure we'll talk about. But yeah, you're right so far.
Oh, great. Okay. Good. Good to know. No pressure.
Do you not feel a little bit uncomfortable, Vicky, that he picked a movie that he's read a book twice about?
Yeah.
I think we may see Tilly Trivia jump the shark this week.
Well, if that's the end of Tilly Trivia, I suppose we'll have to learn to move on.
Go out on a low.
So then we've got Bill Murray, apparently after Tom Hanks turned it down. Is that right?
That didn't come up in the book. He didn't talk about any other casting, but I have read that a few places.
So that's a long way of saying that's correct, Vicky. Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah,
I guess the thinking with Tom Hanks was that as soon as you see him, you know he'll end up being good. Yeah. Whereas with Bill Murray, it's more of a doubt because he is slightly... Harold Ramis says on the commentary, there's a nasty side of Bill that he wasn't afraid to show in this film.
Mm. On and off camera, apparently.
Yeah, and he also says Bill understands vanity and self-centeredness.
Okay.
So, yeah,
it's a sly dig.
He's playing himself, essentially.
I didn't hear about the Tom Hanks thing
until researching it this time, but I had heard about the Michael Keaton thing. Because Michael Keaton was actually offered it and then turned it down because he didn't understand the script.
Okay.
And he's since said, obviously, he regretted that. But he did get to work with Harold Ramis and Andy McDowell later on Multiplicity, which is obviously the classic lose-lose scenario.
So then you've got Bill Murray and Harold Ramis reunited, a very successful partnership that we've seen in Caddyshack, Stripes, and a little indie that I'm fond of called Ghostbusters. Although they did fall out after this, and they didn't, Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, and they didn't speak again until Harold Ramis was dying, which is terrible.
Yeah, the Harold Ramis quote, which is, he describes Bill Murray on this movie, and this is an actual quote, as really irrationally mean and unavailable, which, strong words.
Although I did think, you don't know you're having a lifelong argument until you've had a lifelong argument, do you? Like, I'll never speak to you again. We'll see. So, you know.
I think it's clear from Danny Rubin talking about, from Stephen Tobolowsky talking about making this film, Harold Ramis, I think he was going through a divorce or a messy breakup, Bill Murray, and I just think he was in a very, very bad headspace. He also felt like he was making a very different film to the one that Rubin had written or Ramis was directing, and so he sort of, he took Rubin away with him to a hotel for a week and rewrote the script with him. And I think there was just a lot of pushing and pulling over what the tone of this film should be.
Yeah, because Ramis wanted it to be a romantic comedy and Bill Murray wanted it to be, which sort of, I imagine, fits with, if you're going through a divorce at the time, something far more philosophical and musing on life and the point of existence.
An existential drama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And repetition. And what is the point making an impact?
But I do think a lot of it is Murray. Like, you know, we talked about it when we did the Scrooged episode, and he has a unique way of making a film. And Dan Aykroyd, who obviously has worked with him numerous times, says he has mood swings, and Dan Aykroyd refers to him as the Murricane, which I quite like. Bill Murray says, I only got this reputation from people I didn't like working with, or people who didn't know how to work, or what work is. Jim, Wes, and Sophia, they know what work is, and they understand how you're supposed to treat people. Jim Jarmusch, Wes Anderson, and Sophia Coppola, I believe.
So I'm going to assume that we don't really need to talk about the plot too much. Is that all right to say? But I will just sort of run through the headline points.
Sounds good.
So Bill Murray is Phil Connors, and Phil Connors is a snarky, jaded weatherman sent to a small town called Punxsutawney to begrudgingly cover the Groundhog Day ceremony. And as Alex has said, that's like a big rat that decides how long winter's going to last. He's not into it. And then he has to relive the same day over and over again until he somehow, with no clues, no guidance, but he has to get it right. And then we see the same day with him. We see the same day in the film, I believe, but Chris will definitely correct me, 38 times. But I've heard he's meant to be living that day for about 10 years.
Well, Ramis said originally 10 years, and then he altered his answer later and said it's probably more like 30 or 40 years.
Okay.
Although at the time, there was talk, I think Danny Rubin originally wanted it to be 10,000 years in his original script. Yeah. And Harold Ramis played on that because he's a Buddhist, and for a soul to actually improve and actually be reborn as a better soul takes 10,000 years. So, good luck. Mm.
Rubin wanted it to be what he said he wrote. He didn't want to put a number on it, but he felt like he should have been there for more than one lifetime,
right,
is how he put it. To learn how to live a better life, you need to have been there a lifetime. So that would effectively be sort of 70, 80 years. The studio wanted it, the notes the studio gave was, we want it to be 2 weeks he'd been stuck there.
That's great.
We don't want it to be too extreme. And I don't know if...
then there's just like a bad holiday.
But you say that, like 10,000 years. When you watch the movie and imagine that has been going on for 10,000 years, it does add an element of pure misery and depression to the whole process. Mm. Like, you can't enjoy it as much if you think this has been going on that long.
And in that original script, he had quite a clever way of Bill Murray recording how many days he'd been there, because, of course, if you write it down each day, it's going to disappear the next day. So he couldn't keep a note of the days.
Right.
And it'd probably be quite hard to remember after hundreds and hundreds. So there was a library in town, and each day he would go to the library and we'd read one page of a book.
Right.
And so he would count it via the amount of books he's read. And it started off with one book, you know, 300, that might be 1 year.
Okay.
And then it would sort of pan out and you'd see that he's read one bookcase, several bookcases, a whole wall. Mm. And that's how they recorded it. But it was Ramis who took that out of it. And that was how they settled on the fact that actually we're never going
to
give a number.
Yeah, that to me is one of the best things about it, is what the script hides from you. So I've got some feedback and I've split it into three sections as per my intro. Hated it, lukewarm, loved it. Are you interested to hear that? I'll be super quick. It's like bullet points, right? Hated it, feels very long, not enough laughs. Eye sculpture face, bad. When I felt lukewarm about it, it feels timeless and Bill Murray is okay. And then when I loved it, I was thinking about the philosophical outlook and then what is not said in the script and the fact that there isn't a reason for why this is happening to him. So there was a gypsy curse in and that was taken out and it's just...
Well, that's the interesting one because that was forced on Danny Rubin by the studio. They were like, look, we don't like you just sort of dropping him into the action so quickly. Because I think initially it started, the original script had him already... in his Groundhog Day.
It started on, in Danny's mind, it started on day 365.
Right. But he was already in the time loop, and then you gradually, as the audience, sort of discovered what the hell was going on.
And it's really funny, actually. A lot of it's told via voiceover. Mm. So he's going around, he's punching Ned Ryerson, he's doing all these things in town, and you don't know what's going on, but in the voiceover, he's saying, you know, you won't get it yet, but trust me, stick with this. I know what's going on. You'll see soon.
And the studio were like, no, we want something that brings our audience with you, a sort of classic, yeah, sort of romantic comedy, supernatural intro. And they asked him to write that. And so what Danny Rubin ended up writing was Phil unceremoniously dumps his girlfriend Stephanie at the very start of the movie. And then as he's going to bed in Punxsutawney, we see Stephanie in her room using Phil's business cards and a broken watch set at 5:59 a.m. to perform a magical spell from a book titled 101 Curses, Spells and Enchantments You Can Do at Home. And that sets it in motion, an embittered ex-girlfriend with a little book.
Okay. Well, there's another thing that he wrote in this book, How to Write Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm. He actually says he wrote a different scene. And I feel like, you hear sometimes that people purposely write a bad scene because they know it'll be taken out.
It's your classic negotiating tactic.
So the studio were suggesting it was a scientific invention, a cosmic anomaly, a magical encounter, an ancient artifact, a wronged girlfriend at the TV station, or a magical clockmaker. He wrote a scene where...
wait, go back. What was the last one?
A magical clockmaker.
Brilliant. Where's that?
We'll use that. Let's use that on something we write. But actually, what he ended up writing was that night in Punxsutawney, Phil pissing off a gypsy in a queue for an Iron Maiden gig.
What?
Which is so, like, doesn't make sense for the rest of this story that I just feels like he just thought, what is the shittest thing I can write? So he pushes in front of this gypsy woman because he's the weatherman, the news guy, gets into this gig and she's upset with him and he just kind of laughs in her face.
So it's like Drag Me to Hell?
Yes.
Right.
Cool. Except shitter, because that made a bit more sense in Drag Me to Hell, didn't it?
I don't know. I feel sorry for the girl in Drag Me to Hell. I always
so
have.
Do I.
It's really mean. Really mean. You shamed me. You shamed me.
Get over it.
But yes, yeah, so, brilliantly, they didn't have any explanation for it, which is part of the success of this film.
Definitely. Definitely, definitely. So he's stuck in a time loop. And he goes through the stages. Well, I mean, people like to talk about the stages of enlightenment, but you can just come along for the entertaining ride. When he first realises, or more or less when he first realises what's going on, he sort of chases after pleasure, which is completely understandable because there are no consequences. So he's going to do what he likes, which involves crashing a car. Is that right?
Yeah, I really like this sequence.
Oh, and eating cake.
This is the no consequences bit at the start. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and he does do the car crashing and... He sits with the two guys in the bar, and it's those two guys in the bowling alley who basically go...
Yeah.
And because that is one of the best lines in it, where he says to that guy, what would you do if you were stuck in the same place every day doing exactly the same thing and nothing you did really mattered? And the guy goes, well, that about sums it up for me.
Steve. Great. Really do. Then once he gets over that, have I got this in the right order? Then he decides he's going to, like, he needs to have sex with Rita. And so that's basically it, isn't it? And so,
yeah, I struggled with that. And it was only this time watching it, because normally I'm along for the ride, but because we have to analyse these bloody movies now, it nightmare. Rips all the fun out of them. But seriously, I was sort of like, he says quite far into it, like, from the first time I met you, I knew I wanted to hold you. And it's not a joke, and he's not trying to hit on her at that point. He's genuinely saying, from the first time I saw you, I wanted to hold you. And you're like, I don't know, it's sort of like, he just seems bored and she's the nicest person in town.
She's so nice.
He's also slept with most of the other women in town that are available by figuring out what high school they went to and what drink they like. And if you know that information, women will definitely sleep with
apparently
you.
Apparently,
even if you look like Bill Murray.
So delete those Facebook profiles, girls.
But she won't shag him, despite his best efforts, despite him memorising her drink, which is sweet vermouth on the rocks with a twist.
Apparently Harold Ramis' wife's favourite drink, which is why it's included, and is disgusting.
It's disgusting. Where's the fucking gin? The minute she ordered it, it's like, do you mean a martini, idiot?
I found it a bit of a turn-off as well when you found out what she likes to toast when she drinks.
World peace.
World peace? Piss off, woman. And like, that's making him fall further in love with her. No, it's not. You run a mile when someone says that.
But this is the thing. This is why it doesn't add up. Because when, like, the real him is brilliant, and like the fake him is so obviously fake. And I guess by the end, we're supposed to believe he sort of found a happy medium where he's not quite as cruel. But when she goes, did you study like filmmaking journalism at university? He goes, no, I studied 19th century French poetry. And he goes, what a waste of time. And she's like, and then he's like, I mean, for someone else, that would be an incredible waste of time. But and it's just like, that's funny.
It is. That's one of the best lines, isn't it? And that's when he's supposed to be learning all the tricks. So it shows you that he hasn't changed at all, because that's his first reaction, is to call it a waste of time, which, you know, possibly it is. But then after that, after she won't sleep with him, there's a lot of montage of nothing he does works, and she slaps his face as a sort of coda to those scenes. Like, so this is not working. Then he becomes super depressed about everything and tries to kill himself multiple times. And that's the beginning of his redemption, because he can't kill himself, it doesn't work. And then he tells Rita the truth and she believes him, and that they have a really nice day together. She seems to want to spend time with him, and that's when you start the arc of he's going to do nice things for other people and sort of build towards becoming a better person.
Yeah. And the snowball fight is one of the most memorable scenes for me, where it's the second time round.
Second one's brilliant. Where he's trying to recreate this perfect moment that they had.
And he's rushing it, and he's like screaming at the kid, are you any of you up for adoption? And it's the bit where in the first time they sort of naturally collapse into the snow next to each other, and it's beautiful. And the second time, because he's trying to get the perfect position, just like the first time.
She moves away.
He keeps reangling himself.
Sort of shuffling, trying to remember exactly how he was. Yeah, that's good.
There was one scene that didn't make it into the film that was very funny in the book, where he's trying to kill the groundhog.
Oh,
and because he just thinks, well, maybe that will fix it all if I kill this frigging groundhog. And so he's chasing it around, and you see a bunch of different versions of him killing it. But it's exactly the same as Caddyshack, so they had to take it out. Once they cast Bill Murray, they said, we can't have him chasing a little creature around trying to kill it. I like the scene where they have some fun as well with, if you know what's going to happen on a day, the scene where he's sitting with the old people watching Jeopardy.
Oh, that's my favourite.
And he knows all the answers. And that once kind of happened to me. I got back from the pub with my mate Springy, and he's quite competitive.
What, can I ask why he's called Springy? Because it's a
Wait, let me guess. Is his last name Springer?
No.
Oh, wow.
Is it because he's really bouncy, like Tigger in Winnie the Pooh?
He is quite bouncy. No, he's really bouncy. He played for a hockey club called Springfield, and we met through hockey.
Can we think of a better reason?
100%. No, the Tigger one works. And he's a competitive lad like me. We were a bit pissed, and I said to him, this is terrible, but Question of Sport was on the telly, and I said, I bet you £10 I beat you at this. And he's like, all right. And so we did it, and he beat me. And it was only a week later he told me it was a repeat. He'd seen the episode, and he knew every answer. To the point that he was getting them wrong on purpose, because he was beating me easily.
To throw you off.
You bastard.
That's so brilliant. That scene I love.
Bloody Springy.
I know.
It's classic Spring.
Classic him. Classic, he's so Spring. Like that.
I don't think Vicky was pointing out that scene was her favourite because of that. But am I right in thinking it's one of my favourite scenes as well, because he's watching a game show in pyjamas drinking Jack Daniels from the bottle.
And when he's talking about what would be your perfect day, it's like, that's my perfect day. Like,
look, can you read that from here? I wrote, living the dream. Living the dream.
It seems so perfect. Just nice company, and it's calm, and you're smashing it at Jeopardy.
Although that old lady, when he says one of the answers before the question's been asked, and he looks at her really aggressively while he says the answer.
And that's the whole ending of, have you seen Starter for 10?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the ending of that film. The whole film is all based around that.
But you ask a good question there, Vicky. Is there a day that you would like to repeat over and over again that you've lived?
Oh, so not a made-up day.
No.
A real day.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, shit.
Does Mark listen to this?
No, he does not.
Okay,
no,
good. So, doesn't have to be about Mark then.
Yeah, it was the time I spent a whole day with another man. it was quite something.
Did you do a comedy eyebrow raise at me then? Hello.
Every day I have with Mark is perfect.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Is there a day while Vicky thinks of one? Well, I still want one.
No, I was quite interested in Bill Murray's perfect day, where he's talking about meeting that girl on a tropical island, and he goes, what does he say? He says something like...
We ate lobster.
Yes. And we made love like sea otters. So I remember hearing that and going, "Gah!" But that's sexy. Just for the record, I looked up what a sea otter sounds like when it's having sex.
Why is there only one noise?
Well, there's only one sea otter in it. I mean, I think that the other sea otter is passive.
Why?
Well, I didn't want to actually put...
Stop doing it.
It's an animated sea otter.
Just if only one person's making a noise, they're not doing it right.
You both deflected that question quite nicely, so congratulations to the pair of you.
Do you have one?
Well, probably today.
Oh, that's me. What about... I love Christmas Day. Christmas Day is a perfect day. I genuinely do. It's a perfect day for me. I love Christmas Day. I also like...
A particular one or just Christmas Day?
Just Christmas Day. Just they're always good.
So you were asked if you would like to relive one day and you're picking every Christmas.
Every Christmas? Mm. I like my own birthday.
But borrowing Vicky's idea, the day I got 1987... Mm. Maybe a bit early, 86. Well, it was the year I got loads of Star Wars toys, including an AT-AT Walker, and it was the best Christmas ever.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, an AT-AT Walker. I still
have
the guns at the front that's still moving.
Me and my friend went to the Alton Towers Hotel, and then you can get into the theme park before everyone else. That was a good day. And we were grown up, so afterwards we could have drinks. It was really good.
That's so cute.
I know, honestly. Can you imagine what it's like? To go to Alton Towers and there's no queues for anything.
Oh, sorry. Oh, no, that must be amazing.
Oh, is that a perk of your job?
Yeah, done that. Been to Alcatraz before it was opened. Walked around Alcatraz at like 5 a.m. It was great.
That's not a theme park, okay? And it's dismissive.
They make it feel like a theme park when you're there, yeah.
Have they got piped noises of people screaming?
Yeah, it's on the headphones. It's on your headphones when you go around. Yeah,
and they've got people reenacting the voice of the guards. Well, this prisoner was pretty bad. Let me tell you a story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine would be the 1997 Championship playoff final.
Oh, good.
That day.
God.
1997.
Yeah. What is that? Wait, let me think. 1997. So was that would be.
Was it Sheffield United? Yes, it was, Vicky.
Oh, well,
funny you should ask, against Crystal Palace.
That was a really.
And David Hopkins scored with 2 minutes to go, a rocket in the top corner.
And did Crystal Palace win?
Crystal Palace win, went to the Premiership, and I was surrounded by my friends and family at Wembley watching it and had just a lovely day and a lovely night.
Oh, that is nice.
It would be a good day to
relive.
Yeah,
but then
really
it would suck the joy out of it. So actually, you don't
I guess I would know the goal. It would be very exciting knowing the goal's coming.
Oh, the question is this. If you were to relive that day, like, are you aware that you're reliving it or not? Because that's the big thing. Mm. Because if you're aware that you're reliving it, so you are. Well, then I think you'd end
up... That's the plot of Groundhog Day. Did you not pick that up on that?
Yeah, I know. I was just practicing sort of like working through ideas and spitballing.
Okay.
So I think you'd end up being disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you should. I think
well, it's like...
Well, I mean, that's the point of the film, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always going to end up... Well, you'll go through different emotions,
won't
you?
I think that's the point of the film. The point of the film is becoming a better person. Taught a lesson by who? Who does this to Phil?
A gypsy. Oh, no.
But you go
Does anyone have a theory? Because I know it's not really addressed. In the movie. Do you think it's the groundhog?
No, it's the plight of all human experience. It's everyone at the same time.
Yeah, but who does it to Phil? Why does he get trapped in this time
there's
loop?
There's a theory online.
Ooh, is it my theory? I came up with a brand new one, so if this is that theory...
Do yours first.
No, do yours first.
It's Ned Ryerson controlling it all.
Oh.
Ned Ryerson's the devil, and it's only at the end when Phil accepts what Ned Ryerson is saying and buys life insurance off him, which he does on the final day, that he breaks the spell.
Wow. Although that theory doesn't work because they bump into Ned Ryerson. Oh, although you don't know, they bump into him after he's bought life insurance, because the moment you know that the loop is broken is when it starts to snow, when they kiss, and you can see Bill Murray sort of look at him and go, this doesn't normally happen.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, that's when it starts to snow. And it's the same thing in It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's not my theory. My theory is the person in charge of trapping Bill Murray in this time loop is the cop who he speaks to when they're trying to drive out of Punxsutawney, and the blizzard comes in, and the cop says to him, he's like, I want to get out of here. And he goes, no, you can go back to Punxsutawney, or you can go ahead and freeze to death.
In hell.
Emotionally.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I'm thinking the cop is like, there's something about that cop. When you watch it, there's a sort of aura to him. He's a very intense cop. And I think he's saying, I'm telling you, go back to Punxsutawney and work this shit out about yourself.
He's an angel, sort of. But also, on a more serious note, isn't it a better experience if you accept that it's no one's fault? Because you can't put blame on your miserable fucking life onto someone else.
Absolutely, you can and you should. Don't ever, sorry, not to say you're wrong, but if anyone out there is sort of thinking, this is my fault, it's not. It's definitely someone else's, and you point the finger as much as possible.
Mom.
towards the end of the film, there is a bachelor auction.
There is.
Which is quite a funny scene. The character that Chris Chris Elliott plays.
Elliott, yeah.
That's quite funny. Vicky.
Yeah.
Nervous.
Why don't you like it when he says Vicky?
I just don't like it when anyone says...
It's going to be a leading question.
Because people don't really often say my name,
all right,
do they? Like,
Victoria.
That's worse. Go on.
Anything's better than Lady V. I'm glad that stopped being a thing. Can I just say how pleased I am that you've stopped that?
It is funny. I listened back to an episode and he says it, but he's looking at me and you do like look, you genuinely wretch, and it is quite
it's
funny.
Just... don't do it now to prove a point.
LV. What would you bid on Alex Zane and what would you bid on Chris Tilley?
Is it for charity?
Yeah.
Oh, well then Lords, because it goes to charity.
No, who would you bid
you
more
go.
On?
Let's cut to the chase. He's not just asking, would you bid?
Oh, right, sorry.
He's looking for a bit of an ego massage that you might bid more on him.
Who would you rather spend a day with?
This is getting weird. Who would you rather spend just more time like just one on one.
Who is going to make an ice sculpture of my face? I think is the first question.
And that's a bad thing by your that you
yeah,
don't,
do you want that or not want that?
Do you not think it's the weirdest thing you've ever seen in your life? And also talking about, if you know where a woman went to school, she'll sleep with you. If you know this, you know, the scene where he tries to convince Andy McDowell to sleep with him, I do find extremely troubling because he tries to woo her with like creature comforts. He's like, we have a fire and I've got a book and I've got some ice cream.
But these are all her favourite things that she's clearly mentioned previously.
There is no mention in that scene of their joint or her sexual pleasure. So he's trying to get... So do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that is like women don't have sex for pleasure. Therefore... access to their bodies can be withheld and therefore negotiated or taken. And we can't be having any of that for obvious reasons.
I found the Nancy scene when they're canoodling by the fake fire more troubling because he calls her Rita.
Yeah.
And she's like, whoa, who the fuck is Rita? What are you doing? And then he says, I love you. I've always loved you. Will you marry me?
Yeah. And that works.
And that makes her more horny.
Right. Then he calls her Rita again. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Because apparently now that he's committed to marriage, he can fucking call her what he likes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is not.
That's a joke.
How it goes.
That's a joke that I don't think worked then and now is dated very badly.
Yeah. But even at the end, if you were on essentially the first date you've ever had with someone and they're like, ta-da, ice sculpture. And then they say, and I've always loved you. You'd be like, listen, it really is getting quite late. So I thought I might go and never, ever, ever ring you or see you ever again because this is fucking terrifying. You know what I think? It annoys me that she's like, oh, I've had a declaration of love. That's just what I always wanted.
Is it the combination of the declaration with the ice sculpture, though?
I mean...
On its own, are you sort of open to love declarations?
On the first date?
Yeah.
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think anyone is a normal person.
No, that's fine.
Would you like...
I mean...
You're not writing this down.
What's your favourite drink again, Nikki?
Was that...
I know. I actually know. It's a large, crisp white wine. That's what you said to me.
I do like a crisp.
It's got to be a crisp one.
What did she say? No, she didn't. She said white wine and a packet of crisps.
No.
Who wants a brackish, warm, muddy wine?
But then I had to go to the bar and say, have you got any crisp wine here?
Did you really? Oh, you should have.
I was taking the piss out of you while I was doing it.
When did it stop being blue WKD?
Would you like to know the ending in the original script, which has a twist?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really
interesting. I know this. It's good.
It's really interesting. So they wake up that next day next to each other in bed,
And Phil is over the moon saying much of the same things. We're going to and she's very nice. She's pretty happy about it. And they come down to breakfast. And eventually she says something quite rude, like, I've had enough of this, something like that. Mm-hmm. The twist is that next day, Rita ends up repeating.
Cool.
So every day she wakes up having just slept with Phil next to him.
Okay.
And has to pretend that she's not in love with him, or she's not sure if she's in love with him.
Yeah.
But he's had all those days to fall fully in love with her. She's just had that one day exactly. Where she likes him.
Yeah.
And so the ending is her stuck in purgatory, essentially, which is a nice twist, but isn't the feel-good ending that, you know, helped make this a huge success.
She has a very specific...
waste cult. Sorry.
Or if you're in America, they call that a vest.
She is. She wants. She knows what she wants from a man.
Oh, she does. Yeah.
She does want a man who will change poopy diapers. Mm. To which Phil says, "Does he have to say poopy?"
It's vile. It's so winsome. It's annoying.
Do you like her character though?
With a bit of distance from the film, I do. But when I'm watching it, I do find it a bit so sweet that it makes my teeth jangle a bit. Like, she's just. So cute and so lovely and is nice to everyone all the time. And her long description of what she wants in a man, unless she's taking the piss, is ridiculous and irritating. Like, he needs to be brave and love his mom and like animals. It's like, who? And as much as I say it's unfair for men to put unrealistic expectations on women, I think it goes both ways. Like, this man that she's describing would be, it doesn't exist and would be boring if he did exist. And I don't know why a grown woman projects that sort of thing onto people.
Do you think it's written by men who aren't that kind of man to basically go, this is unrealistic to expect this?
Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, with a bit of time, it's like she needs to be the nicest person in the world in order for the narrative to work. But it's just a bit of a shame that she doesn't get any edge to her.
That final scene you were talking about where they wake up in the bedroom the morning after, which still happens in the movie. Apparently one of the biggest conversations that had to happen on set was... Bill Murray was like, I'm not shooting this, Harold, until you tell me if I'm wearing pyjamas or not in this scene. And Harold Ramis like hadn't given any thought to this. And so he took a vote from the crew and it was a tie. They weren't sure whether Phil should be wearing pyjamas or not. And I guess it suggests whether or not he had sex with Andy McDowell that night or not. And apparently it was more than one people corroborate the story that it was a young girl who was the assistant set designer on her first movie who went, if he doesn't have any pyjamas on, it will ruin your fucking movie. He has to be wearing pyjamas. And so that's why he's wearing pyjamas. And I agree. It would be sort of like, And also it would ruin the reveal as you pull back. Because if he's not wearing pyjamas, you immediately know that it's a new day.
And I think
then the halfway point is top pyjamas, no bottom pyjamas, and that makes you feel sick.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I'd be doing it right now if I could.
Up there.
I'd be doing it right now if
why
I could.
Why do you do it? What sort of weird, deviant pleasure do you get from that?
I think the boys should be free down there.
Oh, God.
Right, should we jump into the things we liked?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not the bit. It's called the bit.
What's your favourite scene, Vicky?
You have mentioned it, but the snowball fight with the kids when it's just like, just so manic and like, you were afraid of Jen, I love kids. That's very funny.
Al?
I really like the chase sequence in the pickup truck where Punxsutawney Phil is driving and he's on his lap and Bill Murray ad-libs the line, don't drive angry, don't drive angry, because apparently the rat was trying to get out of the van at that point, and shortly after that, it bit him, and he had to have a rabies injection.
Yuck.
So that's I do like that scene. I like animals driving cars mainly.
I like what Ramis calls the Superman sequence when he catches the kid, changes the tire, does the Heimlich maneuver on the mayor, who's his brother in real life.
Yeah.
And then just after that Heimlich maneuver, I love it. He's walking out. He just lights a woman's cigarette as she's pulling it out. I think that's a really nice little button on the end.
That's
of that.
His brother. He performs the Heimlich maneuver. On?
Literally just said
he
that.
Just said
oh,
that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was reading
10 seconds ago.
Really? That was his brother.
Okay.
Okay, MVW, most valuable whatever, Alex.
Oh, wait, I've got one. You know that kid who falls out of the tree?
Yep.
No, the thing you just mentioned that wasn't about the brother. The kid who falls out of the tree. If you watch the bit where he takes the old guy to hospital and is informed that he dies, you can see the kid with a broken leg in the hospital waiting room.
That's nice.
From one of the days that Bill Murray didn't catch him. So he doesn't die if he falls out of the tree, which I think, removes the jeopardy from that scene where he catches him. What was the question, Chris?
MVW. Vicky, what's yours?
It's Ned. Ned Ryerson. I just think he's very funny, and he, when Bill Murray repeatedly steps in the puddle, he does look quite gleeful about it. So he's not just this sort of one-sided, like, he loves Bill Murray and he wants to reconnect with him. He is delighted that he's stepped in that disgusting puddle.
That's a doozy! Does anyone know where "that's a doozy" comes from, the expression?
No.
It's a 1930s very fancy...
the war!
No.
All right. Oh, okay.
But good, good. I mean, you can wait to hear the answer or you can have another guess.
A polls. Carry on.
It's the 1930s... car called a Duesenberg in America, a very fancy car, and it was nicknamed the Doozy, and that's where the expression "it's a doozy" meaning it's something special.
Good fact.
I like that. Yeah. I've got even more random one coming up.
About cars.
Wait, so what was the question?
I mean, that's the second time he's done that. Well, I'm going to jump in now because I've got the same one as Vicky. Mine is Ned Ryerson. Do you know why he's called Ned?
No.
The screenwriter was thinking about Ned Beatty when he wrote it. Okay. That was who was in his head. And can I give you just a bit of random trivia that I've always loved that connects Stephen Tobolowsky, the actor who plays Ned Ryerson, with one of the great indie bands of the last 40 years?
Yes, you can.
So what's the band?
That's the ending.
Okay.
So he worked with David Byrne of Talking Heads fame on a movie called True Stories, which I recently saw for the first time, from 1986, a weird... comedy musical, a bit kind of David Lynch, Coen Brothers. And while they were writing the script together, he told David Byrne that he, growing up, had a psychic ability to hear and read other people's tones. He could walk in a room, he would hear tones that you were emitting, and he could tell things about your future. Now, this sounds mad, but Stephen, that actor, believes that. David Byrne liked it so much, he put it into his film, a character having that same ability, and wrote a song about that character called Radiohead. And Radiohead loved that song so much, they named the band after it. And Radiohead is named after Stephen Tobolowsky.
Okay.
So he's the inspiration.
That's great. Can I jump on this trivia train
Let's
right
do it.
Now?
Rock and roll.
Woo, woo. So Talking Heads... there's another Talking Heads story from the set of this where Bill Murray was on set with his little portable stereo listening to the Talking Heads. And Michael Shannon is in this movie.
His first
movie role. He plays Fred, the guy who's getting married and then his wife gets cold feet and then they get wrestling tickets at the end. Anyway, he hears Bill Murray listening to Talking Heads and he's like, he wants to say hi to Bill Murray. And he goes up to Bill Murray and goes, oh, you like Talking Heads? And then realizes what a stupid thing that is to say because Bill Murray's listening to the Talking Heads. And Bill Murray goes, yeah, I like the Talking Heads. And Michael Shannon walks off going heartbroken, crestfallen, going, I can't believe I did that. I'm an idiot. And mentions this to Harold Ramis when they're playing pool. He's like, I did this thing. I think Bill Murray hates me because I said this. And Harold Ramis is like, you probably just caught him on an off day. Lie, obviously. but don't worry about it. It's fine. So it comes around 2 weeks later to the actual scene that Michael's in at the end, at the party. And Harold Ramis stops everyone before they shoot the bit with Bill Murray and Michael Shannon. Goes, everyone, I just want to stop right there. Bill, have you got something you want to say to Michael? And Bill Murray goes... ad verbatim, this is from the lips of, like, Michael Shannon. I like you, Mike. I'm not upset with you. And I'm sorry if you thought I was upset with you. Harold Ramis had made Bill Murray apologise to Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon said, it was one of the strangest things that ever happened to me. I couldn't believe it. I went bright red.
No wonder they stopped talking. That's weird.
Isn't it?
He should have said, like, in a fake take, rather than I got your tickets to WrestleMania, I got your ticket to the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
Everyone would have laughed. You could have moved on.
Yeah.
Michael does say they met years later at Cannes Film Festival. Murray remembered him. They were in the bathroom and then he invited up to his suite to eat cheese together.
That's a dream for me, to be honest.
What would you change in this film? You gave a laundry list of stuff you didn't like.
I've got one change, something a little thing. You know the woman who runs the B&B that Bill Murray's staying at, and every morning she says, did you sleep all right? Do you want some coffee? And he's either quite rude to her or dismissive, whatever. Just thought one cut back to her as he's left, because she says, are you checking out today? And he's like, yes, no, whatever. And it would be fun to give her own moment where she's all like sweetness and light to him. And the minute he's out the door, she's like, what a dick.
Yes. That would be good. I think, a bit like you, I think he is really mean to her because at the very start, the first thing he says, she's like, would you like some coffee? And he's like, any chance of a cappuccino or espresso? And she's like, oh, I don't know. And you hear him mutter, you don't know how to spell espresso or cappuccino, which is just sort of really nasty.
Just twisting the knife.
Yeah. But I think Nancy, there needs to be some resolution to her story.
Yeah. Like,
towards the end, she's sort of dumped with Larry, the camera guy, and like she doesn't like him. And I don't, it doesn't feel like a satisfactory end for Nancy.
Well, actually, I'm a bit of a Groundhog Day super fan, and I've seen the musical, which is fantastic. Words by Danny Rubin, songs by Tim Minchin, and Nancy does get much more. They've thought about it a lot more. I think they righted any wrongs that they thought were in that script, and she does have a proper story arc in it. And you see stuff from her point of view. They also have songs in that musical called, one's called Philandering.
Nice.
And one's called Philanthropy.
Okay.
My change would be to make Rita more interesting and less bland.
Yeah,
she's not a particularly exciting love interest, and no. I feel like she should have a bit more about her. Did you? Are we done with that section?
Yeah, for sure.
Anyone got any other trivia? Any Tilly trivia?
Yeah, if it's our trivia, it doesn't come under the umbrella of Tilly trivia. You know that, right?
We could change the name of the section
to what?
To Tilly trivia.
I don't think you understand the concept of change.
It was briefly called No Tomorrow, the film. The studio had the rights to the song One Fine Day and really wanted it to be called One Fine Day so they could use that. And that didn't work out. But obviously, the Clooney, Michelle Pfeiffer film used that title. Mm. And in Brazil, it's called Black Hole of Love.
Oh, okay. I thought that was something else, but that's fine.
There was an Italian remake called Stalk Day, about Filippo, an Italian TV star who has to go to Tenerife to shoot a program about a local stork and then keeps waking up on the same day.
Oh, I thought you meant stork as in like stalker.
Sorry, no,
oh,
S-T-O-R-K.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stork. Mm. Okay.
And the makers of a short film from 1990 called 12:01 PM tried to sue. And I did watch that short film. It stars Kurtwood Smith, who's Boudica in RoboCop. And it's a half-hour version.
Oh!
Very similar.
Wait, Boudica. Boudica.
Boudica, yeah, Clarence Boudica.
Clarence Boudica, yeah. Okay.
It's Groundhog Day, but with all the humour taken out. It's very disturbing, actually. Okay. Very depressing. Mm. But very similar. But they decided it would be too expensive to sue this studio, so they just gave up.
Just leave it.
Walk away. Any more for any more?
No, I think I'm done with that.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ooh. Right, all you need is kill slash Edge of Tomorrow slash Live, Die, Repeat.
Thanks for the intro. I'll take it from here. So this week, I was given Edge of Tomorrow, a title that, like many of you, I had a problem with. Edge of Tomorrow is just a bit meh. It sounds more like the title of a Coldplay album or a coffee table book with photographs of sunrises or the kind of thing someone trying to sound deep would say at a party just before midnight. I do...
I would totally do that.
You would have sex with that person for sure. Don't you just feel like we're on the edge of tomorrow?
Clever.
Sorry.
Are you writing it down, Chris? I prefer the alternate names that were considered. All You Need Is Kill, Live, Die, Repeat, or my personal favourite, Alien Time Belch. Now that's a name.
That's a joke, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's a great name.
What about Cruise? I thought Cruise Control would have been a good title for it.
Yeah, I think Speed 2 ruined that for everyone. Forever.
What I am about to tell you sounds crazy. But you have to listen to me. Your very lives depend on it.
What day is it?
Judgment Day. You just came in with the fresh recruits.
This is not...
The invasion will fail.
Along with every soldier you are sending, we lose everything.
Come find me when you wake up.
So, Edge of Tomorrow. It's about a guy who repeats the same day over and over again. So it is based on a Japanese light novel, they call it there, which is basically the Japanese equivalent of a young adult novel here. It's called All You Need Is Kill. And then the rights were bought by a producer. I know I'm getting really into like these like Uber producers. I think I did one recently. This guy's called Irwin Stoff. Listen to the movies he's either produced or exec produced. Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Chain Reaction, The Devil's Advocate, The Matrix, Constantine, The Blind Side, my personal guilty pleasure, 47 Ronin.
They're all Keanu Reeves films, there's apart from one.
There's a lot of Keanu Reeves films on his list. They clearly get on. So he gets the rights, and then he asks a guy called Dante Harper to write up a draft script for him to sell. And they write this spec script and they sell it to Warner Brothers for $3 million. And then the genius director that is Doug Liman comes on board having seen Warner Brothers. This script was on the blacklist of the most loved and yet not yet produced scripts in Hollywood.
Do you know what else was on the list that year?
This is 2010. Go on.
2010. Argo, Chronicle, The Hunger Games, Snow White and the Huntsman, Looper, The Butler, Oz the Great and Powerful, and Crazy Stupid Love.
Mm. They're all bloody good scripts.
Big hitters. Yeah.
Well, most of them are.
But that scripts. This, I think it was the biggest script sale that year.
Yeah.
It was I mean, 3 million was a lot because they say, don't they, the spec script market is kind of dead. It doesn't exist like
I was going to say, because when we were talking about Shane Black the other week, like it was sort of this record breaking figure, which was 4 million for The Long Kiss Goodnight at the time, the highest ever paid. But this is still a stunning amount of money. This was in 2010.
This was an anomaly because not only did they sell it for that amount of money, but they also got a clause put into the contract that said that they would get it rolling before cameras within 12 months, which didn't happen. They then renegotiated that. But again, that's a crazy clause for a film this big.
Yeah.
To be making it within 12 months, it just seems they did a good deal. Whoever is their lawyer, I hope he got a big bonus.
I think he probably did, to be honest.
They brought on Doug Liman. And so this is the thing. So we should establish at this point, Doug Liman is a maverick filmmaker. He's got what they call a workshoppy kind of filmmaking style. He's exciting, as we know from going to college together, University. I love Doug Liman.
Yes.
Because Go is one of the greatest films.
I can't believe You've just admitted that to like outside of this friendship.
We talked
circle.
About Go On Here before,
yeah, I think so.
Oh, have we?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a recovered memory for me. Like, I've seen it, I've said this so many times because of Alex. And then the minute I didn't see Alex anymore, it's like, that's gone because what a waste of my time. And then it just all bubbled back up to the surface like over the last year. It's like, for fuck's sake, why have I seen that film?
It's a good
25
film.
Times.
I would watch Go before I went out every Friday night or when I got in every Friday night, or if we didn't go out, I'd put Go On so everyone could watch it with me. Go was a big staple of my university life.
I went to uni with a guy who was a bit strange and didn't go out, and he only had two videos, and every night he'd watch them both.
I don't remember Alex ever going out, if I'm honest.
One of them was Die Hard, fine. The other was Lee Evans Live. He watched that every night for 3 years, as far as I could tell. And sometimes he'd be watching it when I was on my way out and watching it when I come back, so he'd put it on again. Bloody loves Lee Evans.
Yeah, you thought I was weird. There you go. Yeah.
Phil the third year, he was called.
Phil the third year.
Was he? We're all first years, and he was the one third year living in that. So that, I don't even know what his last name was.
That is classic you.
Sometimes I would be pissed though and wander in and watch a bit of Lee Evans just because I could. He's the only one that had a telly.
So Dante Harper wrote this script. Warner Brothers bought it. Doug Liman comes on board, and then Doug Liman does the Doug Liman thing where he's like, I'm not sure about the script. And then, wow, kind of the who's who of screenwriters have a shot at this script at some point. So there's a guy called Joe B. Harold who hadn't done much at that point. He's the first guy to have a go. He'd done Awake, a Hayden Christensen movie. And then he'd just gone on to do, he's doing the new Zack Snyder movie, Army of Darkness, and the Flash movie, if it actually happens. So he's doing that. But he had a go. Then screenwriting duo Robert Orkey and Alex Kurtzman had a go. Then they were gone. Jez Butterworth and John Henry Butterworth, they had a go. They'd worked with him on Doug Liman on Fair Game. They'd go on to work on Black Mass, Spectre, and recently Ford versus Ferrari. Simon Kinberg had a go after the Butterworths left. Then Christopher McQuarrie comes on board. So this script was something that Doug Liman wasn't happy with. And before shooting, despite it being on the blacklist, he discarded 2/3 of Dante Harper's original script. And even after all this, they 8 weeks to go until shooting. And in fact, when they started shooting, they still didn't have an ending, which I think, when you watch this movie, the scars are there in that final third of a movie that's sort of undergone a fair few rewrites. What do you think?
Well, I saw this film twice when it came out, right. Mainly for work purposes, and then obviously watched it again the other day. And both of those times, for some reason, my brain just switches off about an hour and 10 minutes into this, and I can no longer keep up. Maybe because I don't care, or maybe it's because I don't understand. So this is the first time I was literally making notes trying to figure out what was happening, because it just loses my interest that this story does.
There's a massive logic gap, which I know there's your friend, Ryan Johnson, my friend.
I never claimed he was my friend.
You sent us that interview of you two hanging out in a bar or something.
He was talking about making Looper, he was like, look, you can get into a situation where you're explaining how you're doing time travel and you end up doing stick figures and this, and eventually it's like, it just gets boring. Just do what you're going to do, but stick to the rules. And there's I think if I followed the rules of this particular time travel thing, there's a massive gap in logic, which is that if the Omega, which is like the big brain thing, can control time at all, the war is already over, because it can control the future. It sees the future. The future is in the future. It can see as far into the future as it needs to. The war is done and you wouldn't have any memory of it. No?
This is the big womb-like creature at the end.
Or like a brain, I thought.
I called it a womb because there's a really fascinating article about why in a lot of alien invasion movies does our male protagonist often have to enter the mothership.
I wonder why that could be.
Through a small orifice and then destroy it from within.
From the inside.
Yeah.
I got lots of answers for you.
Oh, no. I've read them all. They're great, though. Thanks. It's a quote from Doug Liman about that exact subject, not what I said, what you said about time travel. You don't have to talk to scientists to find out that humans will never travel through time. Just talk to a filmmakers who've tried to put time travel in a movie. The story paradoxes that crop up are so taxing that on this film, at one point, the studio suggested we get rid of the whole dying, repeating the day aspect.
So then it's just a war film with aliens.
But you can imagine them saying that, going,
fuck it.
Is that part essential, or can it just be her training him to fight?
But it is a problem with time travel films. As you say, in Back to the Future, they literally, Marty says, "What's that?" And Doc says, "It's the flux capacitor. It's the thing that makes time travel possible."
Yeah.
Bang. Job done.
Yeah, yeah,
in
sure.
Back to the Future 2, Doc Brown has to pull down a blackboard and do a diagram to explain to Marty, but really the audience, what the hell's going on, because they've tied themselves in so many knots.
Yeah.
And you get that scene several times here. Noah Taylor is the character who is there to try and explain to the audience what is happening.
I wrote that. The bit where he brings out the hologram table.
Exactly.
I wrote,
it's the Back to the Future blackboard
scene.
A lot
of exposition.
Yeah.
Which was when I really had to take notes. And this time I did understand the plot, but I'll be honest, that's the first time I've really been clear on what was happening in the final third of the film. And that, for me, that required notes.
Yeah, because in this version, what you do has consequences. Otherwise, you can't win a war. So, but nothing... Tom Cruise's interactions with the other characters doesn't seem to have any consequence. So in one version, you know, he saves someone's life and they don't get squashed by a big spaceship thing, but that doesn't have any that person's then alive in the next 20 minutes and that doesn't have a causality?
Yeah.
Help me out.
Causality, yeah.
Consequential effects on any of the stuff.
This is the first time I've heard the word causality used outside of The Matrix Reloaded by the architect, where he goes,
"You're welcome.
The causality. Your most pertinent question is also the most obvious."
Oh, nice.
I absolutely agree with you on the fact that I wrote down, it's such a shame because the unit who he joins at the start are such dicks to him initially, because he's like a deserter. Bill Paxton goes, "He's a deserter, he's a bit his ship, be a dick to him," and they all are. And you never really get to see, there's one moment which I wish there'd been more of, where the team get to see him being a badass and he gets that sort of like,
when he runs around in a
circle, around the circle of the creator, and it's like the crater, and you're like, that's an awesome moment.
Yeah.
And that's a great action scene, and doubles as like, because all the best action adds to story. So they're going, "Did you just see that? What the hell's going on?" Which is beautiful.
Mm. Did any of the action in this film make you cry? Like action does sometimes.
That scene, the bit where he's running around the edge, and the opening sort of Normandy landings.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Thing with where they're all down on the ropes. Those two scenes. Doug Liman is a phenomenal action director.
Have you ever interviewed him?
Yes. I interviewed him for American Made.
Me too.
I did. Well, I say I interviewed him. I did a Q&A in front of an audience with him. He's brilliant.
No filter.
No.
I think I've interviewed him a few times, and I've noticed now that the publicists are sitting in on the interviews because he does say whatever he thinks, which is so lovely as a journalist wanting to have an actual conversation.
Yep. Can I quote Emily Blunt, who echoes your sentiment, because apparently. In a meeting early on, he snapped at Emily and Tom, and Emily sort of replied to him, "Easy, I've never made a movie like this before." And he said, and this is from Doug Liman himself, and I said, "Well, neither have I!" And apparently the room ground to a halt, and his producer, Irwin Stoff, told him later that it was the most incredible thing he'd ever heard anyone say, the director telling the stars of the movie that he had no idea what he was doing.
But we'll see you in the morning.
But Emily Blunt
Emily
Blunt says he has no filter when it comes to being honest. You can waste so much time with politeness and diplomacy on set. That's what's so refreshing about Doug.
It's funny though how far they got away. So I've read the source material that this is based on. I read the Japanese book.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and when it was in Japanese.
Oh, less impressed.
There, the love story between Rita and the character that's now called Cage makes more sense. And to get out of the time loop, one of them has to die. Mm-hmm. And so he has to kill her.
Well,
and it carries a lot more emotional resonance.
And I'm surprised. The way I read it, he doesn't know that he has to kill her initially. What happens is she attacks him because she knows one of them has to die. And so she attacks him and he defends himself and ends up killing her. And then she's like, "Well, it had to happen. One of us had to die." And he's like, "I love you." I'm like, this is really powerful. Hmm. Why is it not in the movie? If you're struggling with the ending, just go, "That's fucking great."
Yeah.
Put that in your movie.
Should we talk about the aliens?
Yeah, the aliens are good. What are they called? Mimics.
Yeah, the mimics. You've got the drones, the alphas and the omega.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the design of the aliens?
Or sketchy. As in, I couldn't, I like the training montage where they replicate the mimics with mechanical arms. That's cool. But the actual aliens themselves, because they are arms and bits and whatever everywhere, and it's hard to look at them. I just sort of switched off because I couldn't. They don't need like a cute face for me to engage with them, but they didn't feel particularly threatening.
I think they were described by the designer as black spaghetti.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Okay. But I think it's very difficult to actually, the foot soldier mimics, the ones that are doing all the killing, they don't have faces. They're sort of like...
just arms?
Yeah, just lots of tentacles.
Yeah.
The alphas, the thing that works for me about the alphas and really, really works about the alphas is the noise that they emit where from their face and their mouth, which sounds like a furnace. You know that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that constant furnace sound. Love that design.
For me, I felt like the design of them made them feel like they didn't carry any heft or any weight in the way that sometimes those Transformers films can feel like that. And so the action just felt like a bit of a blur going in front of me. I was finding it quite hard to actually keep up with what was happening in those scenes. So
yeah,
I wasn't moved in the same way Alex was.
And there's a lot of what I will call trench admin. So there's about a 10 to 15, not to 15 minutes, that's rude. There's a sequence where Tom Cruise is trying to teach Emily Blunt what's going to happen in the trench in order to fight their way out of it. And she can't quite memorize it because it's complicated. And we just cut back and back and back. And she's just trying to remember, oh, so I step left and then duck right and whatever. And it's like, oh, this is, trench admin. But I did like the fact that a lot of the moments made me laugh, and I wasn't expecting to find it funny. I assume that's done on purpose.
Yeah, 100%.
So when he rolls under the truck to find Emily Blunt and gets squashed by the truck, that's really funny.
That's really good. A lot of the deaths are, and when he keeps breaking limbs in the training sequence, and she just walks over and puts a bullet in him over and over and over again. I think that's great. I think that a lot of that was Chris McQuarrie. I think when he came on board, Tom Cruise was like, we need to really up the comedy in this so it doesn't feel quite so bleak.
Do you think he was on purpose when he first wakes up after he's been sent packing by Brendan Gleeson and he's like, where am I? And then the camera moves up and there's this massive sign that says Heathrow. It's so huge.
But they're also playing on the audience's knowledge that Tom Cruise is good at everything. And so to suddenly see him bad at a bunch of things in the first half of this film, it's funny and fun to the audience.
But then I did find it confusing because the montage, I see Tom Cruise in a uniform and I'm just like, oh, there's a hero. And he's a soldier to me because he's wearing a uniform. And there's so much to pay attention to in the montage. Then when he says to Brendan Gleeson, I've never been trained for this. I'm just a PR man. It's like, oh, okay. It just took me a while to adjust. Like I could have done with something in the montage that makes it clear that you can wear the uniform without having had any combat training. I've never been in the army, so I don't know if that's how it works. Like,
That's how it works, yeah.
That is how it works, isn't it? You have to kill, three or four people before you get a uniform?
But I thought they made it pretty clear in the dialogue, that he's got no skills, that he's a coward, that he...
Don't buy it because it's Tom Cruise.
But that was the whole selling point in the movie. The whole sell was like, you see Tom Cruise not in hero mode, and he plays this snivelling like person who's like, I don't want to go to the front. Why is Brendan Gleeson so... why does he hate him so?
I've got a theory.
Great, because at the start, it's not, he just basically goes, I'm going to send you there because you're going
to
die.
Listen to this. And I didn't steal it off the internet or hear it from a man. I made it up myself.
Are you listening, Chris?
Are you ready?
Yep.
So, towards, shut up. At the beginning, Tom Cruise, I don't want to go to the front. I don't want to video this, and thinks he's got out of it. And then Tom Cruise is like, oh, I'm glad we've cleared that up because, I don't want to go to the front and video acts of heroism. And Brendan Gleeson shakes his head and he goes, you won't. Cut to waking up at Heathrow, right?
Well, no, because first Brendan Gleeson shouts, arrest that man!
Shut up! That's inconsequential to what I'm trying to say.
Right, sorry.
So he said, oh, you won't. Remember that, right?
Is this, sorry, just for clarity, are you rewriting the opening scene?
No, that's what happens. He says, Tom Cruise goes, glad we could clear that up. I don't want to film acts of heroism.
But we don't smash cut to Heathrow at that point.
Oh, no, so, yeah, that's true. Sorry.
I'm just telling
you. Said that twice.
Right, yeah. I'm just telling you, he runs out and then
maybe
Brendan
you should smash cut to. I love a smash cut. Anyway, smash cut to whatever, or
do you
not.
Know, I read somewhere that smash cut isn't actually a thing and shouldn't be included in a script because it means exactly the same as cut to.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. I'm just saying what I read on the internet. You can look it up yourself.
Anyway, shut up. Right. So he says, oh, no, you won't, because the same thing has happened to Brendan Gleeson and he's doing it all on purpose and we're actually in his loop. Whoa. So he's saying, oh no, you won't film acts of heroism. I know what's going to happen to you because I've lived this day a million times before. Thank you. And that's why at the end of the film, when it randomly resets to just the perfect moment so that everyone doesn't die, that's why Tom Cruise wakes up on his way to Whitehall to see Brendan Gleeson, because now we're in his loop and he's done it right.
Well, Doug Liman has been...
Yeah, loop within a loop.
It took us a while to get there because of a lot of interruptions, Chris. But wow, that's great.
Doug Liman has claimed that the sequel that they've been working on for a long time now is part prequel and part sequel. So I wonder if that will be drawn into it in some way.
God, if I figured it out, I'd be so pleased.
I mean, well, that's a really good theory.
This is what Christopher McQuarrie said on that subject. He said the sequel will explain the ending of the first film. His actual tweet that he put out, the end of Edge 1 will finally make complete sense.
I'm right. I feel like I might be
this
right.
This is what he's saying. And Doug Liman said that the new idea is incredible and that him and Chris McQuarrie sealed themselves in a room and had a screaming match for 2 hours about what the plot should be, but came out with an absolute...
With my idea.
A fantastic idea, yeah. And Chris is on next week to tell you how great you are. Not this, Chris. Although that carries more weight. Sorry, Chris.
And what were your feelings? I mean, it's essentially, it was sort of sold as a two-hander. What did you think about Emily Blunt as Rita?
I think she does a marvellous job for being greased up like a fucking kebab shop counter for most of the film. When you meet her and she's in a yoga pose for no reason and she is gleaming and it's like, I wonder why. Like, I understand she's supposed to be sweating, but it's a prodigious amount of sweat. Mm. And the reason she's so gleaming is to show off her, like, great bod. I get all of that. But I do think it's a shame that we need to repeat that shot constantly.
They do seem very pleased with that shot,
yeah,
don't they?
Do,
in a way.
Oh, hello. Yeah.
Oh, the downward dog.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
No.
Or is it a cat pose?
I don't do yoga.
it's a version of the plank, another name beginning with PL that I can't remember, but yeah, it's a
flat. Plonk.
Plonk.
It's a plonk. It's a plonk.
There we go. Just been working on my plonk.
There we go. I don't even need to do yoga to work that out, but plonk.
I thought she was very good. Mm. Not just for managing the bucket load of lube that she had to deal with.
That's quite graphic here.
I really didn't know it. Anyway, she's back for the sequel as well. She's coming back. The budget, Doug Liman said he would like the budget for his sequel to be smaller than the original. He says the smart way to make a sequel is with a slightly lower budget, not a bigger budget, because what people love so much about The Edge of Tomorrow is the characters and that it's character-driven.
I don't know about that.
I think it's tougher in this one, but certainly with Groundhog Day, they filmed all the different scenes on the same day, which said it made it so much easier for the extras, for Bill Murray, you know, each version of that scene, each different day, filmed them all on the same time. And I think you can do that.
I don't
if
think it's
smart.
For the extras, though. I think that's just convenience. If you're in a location, you just do every moment in that location.
But
right?
They had to do this. It's really good in Groundhog Day. When I was paying attention more this time to the extras, all moving in exactly the same spots every time in the background. I've never noticed that before. Mm. So, yeah, I feel like if you're smart with the way you structure your production on a time travel movie, you can be smart with clever with your budget. It's just this was obviously a bit of a mess going into it in terms of not knowing what the ending was.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And also Doug Liman sort of being Doug Liman. Apparently he actually got on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, he got Simon Kinberg to draft 40 or 50 different endings for Mr. and Mrs. Smith before filming the original version.
I've got the alternative ending that Christopher McQuarrie wrote for this film, but it's so long and complicated, I'm not going to read it out. Okay. I don't really understand
We can do an abbreviated version. The bottom line is that they are told not to kill an alpha because that'll reset the day when they're attacking Paris. One of the soldiers kills an alpha and it resets to them attacking the Normandy landing sequence again, only this time the aliens know they're coming. And they the subtext is that the aliens are going to kill them. Okay.
But the problem was, he said, you were so exhausted by the time you got to that point with that loop.
Yeah, and he was like, the best thing to do would be what all comedies do, or most comedies do, which is everything reverts to how it was at the start. Mm. Which is kind of what happens.
Right, should we do our bits?
Yeah, go on then.
What is your favourite scene, Vicky?
A caravan park in northern France. You don't see that every day.
No.
So when we finished storming the beaches of Normandy, it's just so brilliant to see movie star, dilapidated caravan park.
It reminded me of my childhood.
Me too.
Caravan parks in Brittany. I was like, been there, lived that dream.
Alex, favourite scene?
I've already mentioned it, though, but it was running around the crater, being a badass in his armoured suit. Tom Cruise, loved that moment. Aside from that, it is the multiple hilarious deaths.
Yeah, I'm going with that latter one. I think I counted, I think we see Tom Cruise die 22 times. And kills 7 to 13 are the ones where Rita just keeps shooting him in the head for having a broken back, broken body, broken leg. And then even when he says he's okay, she shoots him in the head.
That's good.
MVW, Alex.
It's the Lyman and Cruise combo. I just genuinely think Doug Lyman is a really exciting filmmaker, not just because of Go, but because I love the films he makes. I love the fact that he... What does he say about the way he makes movies? Oh, I hope I can find it. It's just a really nice quote. I can't find it. He basically goes, look, I don't make movies for a studio. I make them for me and posterity. That's why I don't care what a studio thinks. So he wanted to call it Live, Die, Repeat. And it was a studio exec who called it Edge of Tomorrow. They were like, we're calling it Edge of Tomorrow. And he, when it came out and it didn't do as well as was expected, he says he really laid into the executive at Warner Brothers who'd insisted that Edge of Tomorrow was the better title. I was like, it's clearly not. You were wrong. I committed the cardinal sin of telling somebody in Hollywood they were wrong. Like, literally, I ended up having to call the person and apologize for pointing out that they were wrong. However, they did change it to Live, Die, Repeat, and the sequel is definitely going to be called Live, Die, Repeat, Repeat.
but he
cannot let it lie.
No.
And I'll be interested to see if that does end up being the title, because that's a crap title.
Live, Die, Repeat and Repeat.
Yeah,
yeah,
terrible title.
Do you Live, Die, Repeat is cool. Rule of three. You can't just stick repeat on the
I like all you
Live,
need
Die, Repeat again.
All You Need Is Kill is a great title, but yeah, he said he didn't like it because he was making a comedy action movie and it doesn't feel like the tone of movie he was making.
No, it doesn't.
I think it does, because All You Need Is Kill is kind of like a funny play on kill. As in, like, All You Need Is Love?
Yeah.
But kill?
Yeah.
I think there's comedy in it. I just like it as a title.
Okay.
I meant All You Need Is Kill, Repeat.
My MVW is Rubbish Tom Cruise, because we never get to see that on screen. He's scared, he's a coward, he's bullied by Brendan Gleeson, and I just think it's really fun to play with his image in the way that they did at the start of this film, to the point that I'm almost a bit disappointed when he gets good. But yeah, it's a fun performance, I think. All right, what would you change, if anything, Vicky?
I've said my change.
Yeah.
Brendan Gleeson. Oh, no, you won't. Smash cuts waking up. And you're in his loop. So yeah, all of that piece of movie gold.
Mm-hmm. Alex, what would you change?
What would I change? I would change the ending. There's a couple of reasons. I don't like the Paris attack because...
Oh, do you know why I don't like that? Because...
Go on.
We've been to Normandy, then we go to Whitehall.
Is it not my bit?
Yeah, but listen, right. And then it's like, oh, we've got to go to Paris, and I hate going back on myself. To me, you should have said, we'll go to Scotland, which is not as visually arresting as the Louvre, perhaps, but you know when you miss your stop on the bus and you've got to go back on yourself? That makes me fucking furious. Same feeling.
Okay.
Okay. You happy with that, Alex?
Well, I mean, I don't like the Paris bit for another reason, because it basically, he sort of goes, we need more men. Like, we need more men to actually make this attack. So he goes back to his unit and he convinces them. He goes to great lengths to go, look, trust me, this, I'm living the same day again. And there, and he's like, he proved it to me. Everyone goes, all right, wow, let's do this. And then half of them, when they get to Paris, die off camera. You don't see how whatever happens to, like, any of them. I think, like, two of them, like, get a big sort of moment where they commit suicide to, well, they sacrifice themselves to kill the aliens, but everyone else just disappears off camera. But that's the other problem is, after that, and it happens throughout the movie, I just wish someone had written a different line for Emily Blunt every time Tom Cruise shows up to the training thing. I just cannot deal with, have I got something on my face, soldier? I'm like, what is that line? Like, why isn't it like... What the fuck are you looking at?
Yes,
what the fuck are you looking at? A great line. Is there something you want? Great line. Is there something on my face, soldier? It's just such a laboured line for that moment. Do you not think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to agree with all your changes. Okay. But also, yeah, just we've said it before, but
the nonsense with the title, it was very confusing as an online journalist covering this film, because when they first announced it, we had to call it in Edge of Tomorrow in all our titles. Then we had to call it Edge of Tomorrow dot dot Live Die Repeat in all our titles. Then we had to call it Live Die Repeat brackets Edge of Tomorrow. And I think they're both terrible titles, and I think All You Need Is Kill is a terrible title as well. I think they're all three bad. I wish they'd come with a better title. I don't know what that is.
Alien Time Belch. That's the title right there.
Any other business on this one?
I was looking through IMDb trivia.
Yes, I was as well, Alex, and I think I know what's coming. Did you see this, Vicky? I nearly messaged you.
Life is so short.
Do you want to see it rather than have it told you?
Yeah, why don't you read out, Vicky, what's on IMDb trivia for this fucking film? When you read out what you're seeing, Vicky.
I'm so glad I didn't read that at home. This is from an unnamed source, actually, which is interesting. Yes, Alex Zane said this was one of the best science fiction films of 2014.
This is on IMDb trivia. So, Alex, are you now adding your own trivia to IMDb?
I was as surprised as you when I turned on my laptop, only to discover that I have made it onto IMDb trivia, a trivia section Chris frequently describes as full of bullshit.
Yes. And it asks you underneath the trivia whether you found this useful, and you can click yes or no. This is the first time I've ever clicked that button to say no. Remarkable.
I did host a premiere for this movie.
And right.
The premiere for this movie, that's I'm assuming it came from there. It was where they did the premiere at 6 or 5 or 6 a.m. We had to be down at the IMAX in Waterloo to do the premiere, because they did the premiere at like 7 in the morning. Because it was to promote the movie. Tom Cruise did, you know, he likes a big event to launch a movie. And he did three premieres in the same day. So he went from London to Paris. And then I think they crossed the Atlantic to New York and did one in New York, all within 24 hours.
So not going back on yourself, though, so not frustrated. Mm.
Which, as Emily Blunt said, it's easy for him because he can wear the same suit. I had to get redressed three times for these buggers.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Are you ready for a quiz?
Yeah, I'm ready to be humiliated. Let's do it.
No, I got money on you this week, V.
Great.
I'm going to call this the repetition quiz, because these films are obviously about repeating the same day over and over again.
The repetition quiz.
Exactly.
I'm just testing in case it's like repeating what he said. I just wanted to get in there quickly.
Oh, shit. 1-0 already.
Oh, shit. 1-0 already.
The answer to these questions will involve repeating a word more than once.
Okay.
You'll see. So the first question is, what 1968 kids film is about a flying
chitty,
car?
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang!
Oh my God.
You've got it. So you understand it, I would say, at this point. Who is the actor who played the Equalizer?
Denzel Washington!
Robert Robertson.
He also starred in the original Wicker Man.
Edward Woodward.
Oh, yeah.
Edward Woodward. It's not actually the same word, but fine.
Wood and wood is the same
it's
word.
Wood, you know, wood.
Ward is Ward. Said twice in his name.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit. That's not what you meant.
That is. It is now in hindsight. Hindsight's 2020.
This is a small island in the South Pacific.
Boutros Ghali.
Bora Bora.
Yes, Vicky.
Boutros.
Is that one of the answers? I'm getting in early. Boutros Ghali.
This 1997 film is about a lawyer who has to tell the truth.
Liar, liar.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. Yes. Damn it.
Vicky's back in it. It's 2-2.
Oh, God.
This guy hosted Mastermind for 25
Magnus
years.
Magnus Magnusson.
Yes, she's pulled ahead.
Not movie related, is it?
No, it's the repetition right, quiz right, right. about words right, repeating themselves. What is the flame grilled chicken at Nando's?
Peri Peri.
I can't help but feel that was more of a Vicky question.
I was never not going to get that.
Are they going to take my black card away?
Give it to me.
You can sing this answer if you want. What is the title?
New York, New York.
I nearly did that one, but it isn't. What is the title of the Crash Test Dummies biggest hit? It's not sounding like it yet.
That's not it.
Alex got in there first.
I did
really need Fortums, but that's fine. Phil and Gary Neville both played for Manchester
United.
Yes!
That's their dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, their dad's called Neville Neville.
How do you know that?
I don't know.
What is the title of the TV sequel to Life on Mars?
After Ashes to Ashes.
Correct.
Funk to Funky.
Exactly.
Final question. Shane Black wrote and directed this comedy thriller from...
Kids Nice Guys! Bang. Yes. Oh my God, have I won? Have I won?
The final score is... Alex 3, Vicky 7.
Yes!
That's bullshit. Not 7.
The book don't lie.
You just made that up. That was not right. I got more than 3.
Don't silence me. Don't silence me.
Yeah, all right. You have your victory, as hollow as it is.
He's not a very good loser, is he?
No.
Right.
Only one of us is an IMDb trivia.
Along with the fact that the car they drive out of the French caravan park is a Renault Espace.
Ooh, a car that Emily Blunt crashed into a tree while shooting and nearly killed both of them. And apparently they were so full of adrenaline and so close to death, they both started laughing hysterically.
The verdict.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Ooh. Okay.
So, I picked the films, didn't I? Oh, yeah. So, who wants to go first?
That's why we're both looking at you with these big eyes, sort of going, Chris, guide us.
Alex, loser, you can go first.
As in, you want me to announce the loser, because that's the only way that sentence just made sense. I think I'll go with a winner, classically. So that's why I'm starting. I said it, I think, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, or whenever you announced these movies, or maybe we were just talking about it as friends. It was on the podcast. I said I think I've watched Groundhog Day too many times to actually want to watch it again or enjoy it again. And that turned out to be the case. It's a great film, and I appreciate a lot about it, but I've just watched it so many times that I'm bored of it. And it was a bit of a slog going through it again, even with the special analytical glasses you gave us on, Chris. So I'd only seen Edge of Tomorrow once before, and I really enjoyed it. I think it works both as an action movie and an interesting, weird concept movie, and I love Tom Cruise in it, and I think it's great, and I'm picking Edge of Tomorrow, surprisingly.
Interesting. Vicky?
I didn't enjoy Groundhog Day as much as I expected to, and I enjoyed Edge of Tomorrow / Live, Die, Repeat loads more than I thought I was going to. It was really good fun. But I think we'll still be talking about Groundhog Day in 10, 20, 30 years' time. And the script is just so clever that I'll have to pick Groundhog Day.
Mm.
Chris loves it when it falls to him. Don't go power hungry, mad, crazy. Don't get...
peckish.
Yeah, don't go power peckish.
So...
yeah, your alien time belt.
What I like about Groundhog Day is it isn't just funny and it isn't just clever. I think it does truly capture the weight of time and how it weighs upon Phil. And it does. It's a film that, although it's a light comedy, it does cause you to think about your own mortality. That's what I found myself doing this time. I also think it's really clever that you actually don't want him. No, there's not many romantic comedies where you really don't want him to get the girl at the start of the film. And by the end, you do. So while I like Edge of Tomorrow, I don't really feel like it's about anything. And because of that depth that Groundhog Day has, as well as the jokes, and the fact that it's one of the best films of all time, I'm going Groundhog Day.
I'm happy with that. I think it would be a weird one to pick the movie that was inspired by Groundhog Day as the winner. So yeah, Groundhog Day is a good winner. Well done. Groundhog Day is our winner this week. So looking ahead to the future, whose choices?
They're my choices. So I would like to give... Alex, you are going to have American Psycho.
Thank you very much. I'm a big fan of that movie.
That doesn't surprise
That's weirdly
anyone.
Fitting. Yeah.
Really? Chris, you will have The Rules of Attraction.
Ah, oh, I like those choices, Vicky.
Okay, then. Well, that is it. Next week, Rules of Attraction versus American Psycho. That should be a pleasant episode.
Yeah.
Those two films are a lot of fun. Great. Well, listen, we're going to say goodbye now. But if you would like to rate and review us, we're hugely appreciative of all your reviews. So do subscribe as well on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can get in touch on Twitter @ClashPod. That is it for us. All that is left to do is a welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better on this episode. And so on and so on. It was a good idea, Chris.
Just like Groundhog Day.
Bye-bye!
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.